Welcome back to Stacktrace, your weekly podcast about life, technology, and everything between from a developer's perspective, or two developers' perspective, actually, because it's both me, John Sundell, and my good friend from across the Atlantic Ocean, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Hi, John. Doing great here. And I would really like to know how is your game going, because we have to do the John Swift UI Gaming Corner, right?
Of course. Yeah, yeah. That's a permanent segment now on this podcast, right? Yeah. For better and for worse. I actually don't want to talk too much about the game this week because I haven't been doing that much game development. I've had many other things to do this week, you know. Work that is my actual work, not just the game work. But I did want to bring up one thing that is related to the game work, which is my kind of eye-opening moment of how good it is to keep your code as much as possible cross-platform in terms of Apple's platforms. So when I've been working on the game, I'm writing the game to work on both iOS, macOS, and also on tvOS. Or tvOS is kind of like a little bit of a gray area where it technically runs on tvOS, but I haven't made all the modifications required to make it work really well with a focus engine. So I'm not going to primarily target tvOS, but I still make sure that it keeps running and compiling like technically on tvOS. But the point is that when I've been doing that kind of work, both now with the game stuff, but also when I've been working with Swift packages and other sorts of libraries and things like that that run on all of Apple's platforms, I found that so beneficial because what you can do is when your code, for example, if you have iOS code that also then runs on the Mac, for example, if you're just using the Swift language itself and the standard library, or if you just rely on Foundation, or now if you're using Swift UI and you're not relying on any UI kit specific things, if that code can also run on the Mac, that gives you so much faster iteration times. Like when I'm working on some of my libraries, I almost always run the unit tests and everything, like the things I do when I'm iterating on the code on macOS, because it's so much faster than having to fire up an iOS simulator and run all the tests there. And of course, then I still have to test on iOS occasionally and test on device and all of the other things that we do as part of our kind of workflows. But the iterations, like the very fast iterations that happen when you change a line of code, you test if that works, you change a couple of more lines, you implement a new function, and so on and so forth, I've just found that to be so much more smooth on macOS than on the other platforms. Because, well, there's just less work to be done, right? You don't have to spin up a simulator and run the code on there and report the results back. So having the game and having all of my other kind of libraries and things like that run also on macOS, I've just found that to be a huge advantage in this regard.
Yeah, that's really, really cool. And it's something that's been done by a lot of people from a really long time ago. Like, let's try to test as much as possible on the Mac in this case. I remember when people realized they could kind of create custom watch faces for the Apple Watch using SceneKit and or SpriteKit. I think Steve was one of the people who made a project like that. And one of the targets was a macOS target that would just embed this view of your custom watch face so that you could test it on the Mac and then deploy to the watch only when necessary, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, exactly. Because of course, UIKit and AppKit, they are platform specific, but so many of Apple's other libraries and frameworks and tools are actually quite cross-platform. And just like having a target in your project, even if you're working on an iOS app, like having a target for your kind of code that doesn't rely on UIKit to run on the Mac, I think can just improve your iteration times so much because you can just do those cycles on the Mac and then, of course, still test on iOS from time to time, but you don't have to do that like every minute, right? Yeah. And having those faster iteration times, it is something I think that people find appealing with other kinds of platforms. Like, you know, for example, React Native has always had that as a very strong selling point, that they have that hot reloading, right? Where they just hot reload your code. So it gives you a very nice development experience. And although this is not hot reloading, it's really fast. It's almost as if It was hot reloading.
It's cold reloading.
Right, exactly. And yeah, I've been just kind of opening my eyes to just how nice that is as I've been working on these recent projects. But it's not to say that there hasn't been any challenges with that, because like I mentioned, many of these tools and frameworks do run across all of Apple's platforms, but there are sometimes platform variants. So as a very concrete example, if you want to attach a drag gesture to a Swift UI view, you use the gesture modifier and then you pass it a drag gesture. And that works on both iOS and the Mac, and it's a really nice thing where it will automatically translate between mouse drag events and touch drag events. So you don't need to worry about any of that when you're writing your Swift UI code. However, on tvOS, that is not available. Mm-hmm. So if you try to apply that modifier with that drag gesture on tvOS, you'll get a build time error. So what I've done to handle that is that I've written this little modifier, which enables me to put a conditional compilation in there. So I can say if the OS is tvOS, then just return the view itself. Otherwise, perform this mutation and add this drag gesture. And I wrote about that in a recent article, which we can put a link to in the show notes as well. But the point is that there are sometimes some variants that you might need to handle, but I still think it's worth handling those things and create a cross-platform library, in at least in this case, because of the faster iteration times.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great idea. And this is something you should always be looking for when you're writing your code. There might be some missing abstractions that you need. So feel free to write them. Don't feel limited by what's available from the framework.
Exactly. And especially with technologies like Swift UI, which is so composable. And I know that's kind of turning into a buzzword, right? Where it's like, oh, it's so composable. But it really is, because you're just dealing with values that you're mutating. So if you want to write your own like function that you can apply to a view and you can do some conditions in there, like that is fairly easy to do. And it doesn't require you to like create this enormous abstraction on top of Swift UI. You can have those modifiers and those utilities live alongside with the native tools that Swift UI ships with, which I think is a really, really big advantage for Swift UI in general.
Yeah, something I've been doing a lot when working in Swift UI is something that many people don't do. And many times when you have a more complicated view, it might be an ideal to separate that out into multiple views. But sometimes it's something that's too specific to that particular view where I don't feel like creating a separate view type is beneficial. So I do a lot of extensions on my views, which expose private properties or methods that then return a sub-view hierarchy that I can then return on the main body of my view. And that way I can compose a complicated view with sub-views without having to create separate types for each sub-view. Which sometimes, I mean, it can be a good idea, especially if you're going to reuse that little piece of view. But many times you just have this particular thing, especially if it repeats within the view, where it doesn't make sense for it to be separate because it's not going to be reused or anything. So I've been doing that a lot. And I think it's also showing a little bit of that composable aspect of Swift UI.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you bring up a really good point there, which is separating things out into multiple pieces can sometimes be really good. It's often even really good, where if you have one thing that grows too big, and we've talked about this in many different contexts on the show before, in terms of, you know, splitting up view controllers, splitting up things into different libraries and so on and so forth. Like that is often a good idea when you have something that is big and complicated and you want to split it up into manageable, smaller pieces, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's also a disadvantage to that, where you're creating something a little bit more fragmented. So in your case, for example, if you have a view which has quite a lot of layout rules and is quite complex, but it still only really makes sense as one thing, as one unit, like splitting it up into multiple separate views doesn't really give you any value. That can also be a disadvantage, where in order to work on that view and iterate on it, you will need to kind of identify all those pieces and you will need to work on them in isolation, and you might need to communicate between them. So just having all of that in one implementation, but then adding that additional structure by splitting it out into different methods that add different modifiers or creating extensions on views and making those private in the same file. Like, that makes it so that you still have a pretty nice organization and you can split things up into smaller methods, but everything still lives in one file. So you don't need to jump around your project in order to understand where this view is being constructed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been enjoying a lot working with SwiftUI. That in-app feedback system we talked about last week, I have it pretty much finished. And it was all SwiftUI, the UI layer, of course. And being able to, like, there's this step in the process where it will upload attachments and then do the actual submission. And it has, like, 5 or 6 different possible states. And within those states, there are variants. And I was able to set up a preview in Xcode where I could see all of the different states of this processing screen in just this long list of previews, so that I could work on every single state at the same time, basically, and see how the changes would affect each state. That was just wonderful. And it just increases your iteration speed so much, and it was really a delight to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. Previews is definitely one of those tools as well that really increase your iteration speed, like just like running on the Mac. Imagine now you have a preview running on the Mac, which you do, right? This is a Mac app. So yeah, that just gives you such a nice situation to be in. I also agree that building forms in particular with SwiftUI is so nice, mm-hmm. because when you're building it with an imperative framework like UIKit, you have to manage all of that state yourself. You have to manage all the controls, whether they get shown or hidden, especially if you have a form where depending on what you picked in an earlier stage, you show different controls, right?
Yeah, which is exactly my case, yeah.
Exactly. So in your case, when the user picks either like a bug report or a suggestion, like a feature request, you will show different fields. Yeah. And that is just built in SwiftUI. Like, you don't need to do any work to make that happen, which is just so nice.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit more about what you've been working on. You've been working on that feedback tool, and I also think that you've been doing some work like merging multiple projects into one. Is that right?
Yes. So, you know, sometimes as programmers, especially if you are doing some work for a company, you are going to have to deal with business decisions that end up becoming a technical thing. It happens sometimes. And I'm not going to go into detail here, but basically what happened is there are these two separate apps, and depending on a condition, which I'm not going to describe here, we had to launch one app or the other. Basically, that's the thing. And you can't do that, like that. You can't be springboard, basically.
Right.
The user taps the icon and it launches your app. So, and these are two existing apps. This is not like, oh, we're developing this app where it has two personalities or something. No, these are two existing apps which have been in existence for a really long time, several years. So this is not something like, oh, these two apps were prepared to do this. No, it's something completely new to these apps, and they weren't architected for this. So first of all, I thought, no, we can't do this. Like, that there's no way we'll be able to do this. But then I started thinking, and I remembered that on Apple's platforms, everything is a bundle, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I thought, what would happen if I, instead of exporting this app as an app, I changed the executable type in the build settings to dynamic library, and then I export this. So imagine you have an app, you have all of, it has its own embedded frameworks that it uses, it has CocoaPods, everything, it has also its own build settings, entitlements, info.plist things. It has an app delegate, a main.storyboard, all the works. But instead of exporting that as a .app, which can be run, you export it as a dynamic library. That was my idea.
And how many build errors did you get when you flipped that switch?
None.
Really? Wow, that's impressive.
Well, this is something that happens when you know a little bit about how these things work under the hood, which I do know a little bit. Not like I'm not an expert on the macro file type or anything, but it's basically just a flag. It's just a flag, John. It's just a bit.
Just a flag. Yeah, just change the value. That's it. Done.
So the difference between... There's a lot more, but basically, generally speaking, the difference is there's a flag in the header that says whether that's an executable app or a dynamic library. That's the main difference. And of course, with a framework, which is a dynamic library, then you have your headers and you have your TBD and your exported stuff. But this is an app, so it doesn't export anything. It just has all of these code inside of it.
So it's basically an app, but without like a main.swift, right? Like, to simplify it, of course, you're not writing a main.swift when you're writing an iOS app. All of that is kind of synthesized for you, like the UI application main and all those things. But that's essentially what it becomes. Is that right?
Yes. Actually, now that you mention it, I don't think I removed the main.m file from the build. And it didn't break anything. But let's keep going. Yeah, and to give more context, this is one of the apps is an Objective-C and Swift app, so it mixes Objective-C and Swift. It's mostly Swift. And the other one is a React Native app.
All right, really interesting.
In terms of native code, the React Native app has pretty much just Objective-C. I don't think React uses Swift at all. That's the first step. So change each one of the apps to build as a dynamic library instead of an app. Okay, that's the first step. Then remove the code signature from the built app because it's going to have entitlements and dynamic libraries can't have entitlements. That doesn't make any sense.
Because they inherit the entitlements from their host application, which we've talked about in the context of third-party SDKs and things like that. And, you know, things we have to be careful about when we're embedding libraries and other kinds of code like that, because they get the exact same entitlements and permissions as the main app itself.
Exactly. Yeah. So at runtime, the entitlements belong to a process. So each process has its own entitlements. So it doesn't make sense for a dynamic library to have entitlements. So remove entitlements, remove code signature, remove the frameworks folder from within that these apps, because on iOS, on the Mac, dynamic libraries frameworks can have their own frameworks embedded, but on iOS that's not possible. If you try to upload to App Store Connect with that circumstance, it's going to tell you that embedded frameworks within frameworks are not allowed, at least last time I checked. Okay, that's another step. So the next step is create a new app in Xcode that's going to be your host app. So it's going to be the launcher. And within that app, you're going to embed these two frameworks that you've created, which are actually the apps. And then you're going to also embed all of the frameworks which the other apps use. So are you following me here?
I love that you're phrasing all of this as some kind of tutorial, how to build a Frankenstein app with Rambo.
Yeah, this is amazing. And we actually call it the Frankenstein, but anyway.
Yeah, that's a good name for it.
But you're going to embed those frameworks, but you're not going to link against them. That's very important. You're just embedding those bundles within your app. And I'm not sure if people are aware that you can do this. Like, you can have code, executable code within bundles within your app bundle and not link against them and load them at runtime. So you don't have to have them linked against your app to be able to use them. So at runtime, after the condition has been established at the point which we know which app should be run, then the host app is going to load the bundle, load the main storyboard file, if the app has a main storyboard file, because if you do like the default app template in Xcode, it comes with a main.storyboard file, and that's the thing that will create your main window for your app, your view controller, and by the time application did finish launching is called, your view hierarchy, your view controllers are already in place because the storyboard loading mechanism did all of that. But since I'm running this loading from a dynamic library, I have to do that process myself. So load the main storyboard file, then, and this is, John, this is crazy.
Okay, so we haven't reached the point of crazy yet. This is where you draw the line. I think we pressed that line like 10 minutes ago.
And then you're going to call a method which I wasn't even sure it was callable, which is UI application, share application, set delegates. You're going to change the app delegate while the app is running.
Nice. I remember doing that on the Mac when I was experimenting with having a Swift package, like command line tool, launch a AppKit app. And it was a similar thing where you had to create and instantiate the app delegate and then assign the app delegate to the app itself and then run the app. So I'm guessing that these APIs are almost equivalent on iOS because that's like such fundamental things that probably were inherited from macOS back in the day since iPhone runs OS X.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it's one of those things where you think about like, I'm going to pull the app delegate from under the app while it's in within application did finish launching in some instances, or maybe a little bit later, depending. Because the way it works for the situation we have is, after you've established which one of the two facades should be executed, you don't have to verify that again. So in subsequent launches of the app, it's going to go directly to the correct one. The first time, it's going to take a little bit longer for the whole thing of swapping the app delegate to happen. But then there's another issue, John. If you thought setting the app delegate was crazy, many things on iOS rely on NSBundle, and many things rely on NSBundle main bundle, which is
yep.
your current app bundle. But since these things are now frameworks, they are not the main bundle anymore.
Right, exactly. So is it swizzling time now?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, the loading mechanism, which I've implemented, swaps out the what means to be the main bundle when it decides which one of the apps is going to be executed.
And for those of you listeners who are not aware what method swizzling is, because I've also come to realize that, you know, people who have been working with Objective-C before Swift, they are probably familiar with the concept of method swizzling. Even though you might have not have liked to use it, or you might have not used it in production and things like that, you might still be aware what it is, right? Because it's a kind of fundamental thing in Objective-C to be able to mess with the runtime, right? Because mm-hmm. everything is like dynamically dispatched, and it's one of the things that kind of make Objective-C what it is. But developers now who are only using Swift, and they started learning Swift, and Swift now has been out for 6 years and counting, right? So I don't think it's fair to assume anymore that all Swift developers also know everything from Objective-C. So method swizzling is the art or technique. I don't know if you should call it an art, but it is anyway, when you are swapping method implementations at runtime. So what Rambo is doing here, he's basically replacing the implementation of bundle.main that ships with the system with his own implementation, which can then call another bundle or do whatever he wants. But from the runtime's perspective, bundle.main will be calling Rambo's custom method.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what I've done. And you'll be surprised, but it works.
So I just have one question after hearing this tutorial now and following along, of course, as you were saying, and I've now built my own Frankenstein app here. I've merged three of my projects into one here as we've been talking.
Why not, right?
Exactly. But I just have one question, really. Why?
Well, the why, I'm sorry, but it's a very complicated business reason, which I can't really explain here. But
you're such a manager these days, Rambo. You're just like, oh, it's business reasons. You know, nothing for you to be concerned with.
But it's suffice it to say, it's the only possible solution we came up with, really. Like, we tried, we thought a lot about it, and we really couldn't find any other possible solution for the short term, that is. This is not something that's going to be up in production for years, famous last words.
Right, exactly. You will see that to-do, unmerge these two apps, like you will see that 5 years later. another question, and maybe this is something also that you might not want to respond to in great detail, but is this something that you think might be problematic in terms of the App Store rules and things like that? If you are dynamically choosing which app to launch at runtime, or do you kind of think that Apple views this just as different view controllers being presented? Like, the fact that there are two different app delegates is kind of an implementation detail, right?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it depends a lot on what you're actually doing. In this case, this is basically two versions of the same app in terms of what it does. So it's not like one is a podcast player and the other one is a finance app.
Or a Nintendo 64 emulator.
Exactly. Like, this is basically the same app, but different. And it varies depending on some circumstances. And when we submit the app for review, we've actually got it approved already. We give the app review notes explaining that it's going to look different depending on what they select, and they can check it out. So I think it's fine. We're transparent. It's not like we're trying to hide anything. I think is really just an implementation detail.
Right. Yeah, that seems good. And I mean, it's kind of similar to if you have an app that you've been redesigning, but you're kind of hiding the redesign behind a feature flag because you might want to roll it out. And a lot of companies do this, and it's not something that's, you know, weird or not allowed and things like that, because your design might be drastically different and you want to make sure that it works on a smaller user group before rolling it out to everybody. And then when you flip that switch, then a different view controller would be loaded, like as the root view controller of the app. And it's, even though your solution here is vastly more complex, it's kind of, from a user's point of view, kind of the same thing as just switching between two different root view controllers.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of feature switches, John.
Right. That's a really good segue.
Something happened.
Yeah, something did happen. That is our In the News segment. But first, before we move on to that, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is brought to you by iMazing, the most popular all-purpose iPhone and iPad manager for Mac and PC. Head over to iMazing.com/stacktrace to learn more and to get a 30% discount on your license. With iMazing, you can make Time Machine-style scheduled backups of your iOS devices to your very own storage over either Wi-Fi or USB. And then once you have that local backup, you can browse files, you can browse photos, contacts, notes, calendars, and so much more straight from any backup snapshot, and you can recover just what you need. Backups can and should be encrypted, and they're 100% compatible with iTunes and Finder backups. And for developers, iMazing has a lot of great features. For example, their file browser, which is a great way to get precious insights into how iOS's file system is structured without having to jailbreak your device. It lets you understand what parts of your app's data gets backed up and what kind of data the third-party SDK store as well. And it also lets you quickly test various scenarios by populating your app's library and documents folders with test files. In fact, Rambo, I think you've been using iMazing yourself for tasks like that. And you've talked a little bit about this on previous episodes, but how come you use iMazing yourself?
Yeah, like I mentioned, I love using it to manage my several iOS devices, as our listeners will know that I have for testing. So I love to be able to back up them quickly using iMazing without having to use the system UI, which is not the best, and also replacing app containers very easily so that I can do testing or even to do my marketing screenshots. That's like the best thing about iMazing, is replacing your app container.
Exactly. iMazing is also made by a team of passionate Mac developers, and it shows. It's already supported on macOS Big Sur, and they're always really quick to add support for the latest iOS betas. For example, iOS 14 is already fully supported, and it has been for weeks. Other development-oriented features include a device console. It includes access to device log files, the fact that you can reinstall iOS without erasing your device, exit recovery mode, a battery diagnostics tool, and so much more. So if you want to check this tool out, maybe use it the way Rambo is using it, then head over to imacing.com/stacktrace to try iMacing for free right now. And if you use that link, imacing.com/stacktrace, then you don't only directly help support me and Rambo and help us continue to make Stacktrace, you'll also get a 30% discount on your license as well. But you do have to hurry up a little bit, because this offer is only valid until iOS 14 gets publicly released. So that could be in a couple of weeks from now, we don't really know, but make sure to check that out. Once again, that's imacing, imazing.com/stacktrace. And you can also find a link to that in the show notes as well. Thanks a lot to iMacing for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. All right, Rambo, so now it's time for our In the News segment. And it almost feels at this point that we can rename In the News to In the App Store. Like, it feels like there's so many controversies, debates, and really problems kind of brought up to the surface around the App Store this summer. Of course, we had the Hey app a few weeks or a month ago. Then there was the xCloud situation last week that we talked about. And now there's been a almost like a battle, or even maybe a war, depending how you want to call it, between Apple and Epic Games. And Google also is involved here as well. Yeah. So do you want to quickly recap the story? Do you want me to do it? How do you feel like we should start here?
I can do a quick recap here. I'll be the summarizer in chief here. Cool. So we talked about feature switches before the break, and that's basically what Epic has done. So in Fortnite, they changed a remote thing that enabled users to purchase things within the game using their own system. And it was like, hey, would you like to buy this using Apple or Fortnite? And if you buy through Apple, it's $9.99. And if you buy through Fortnite, it's $7.99 or something. And yeah, so they basically bypassed in-app purchase, the in-app purchase system, which apps are required to use for in-app content, so virtual content. And they did it willingly, and it wasn't just something like they naively did this and they weren't aware. They did this on purpose in order to create the situation we're in right now. It's very clear to me, I think you would agree that, and most people would agree, that this was a completely planned thing, right?
It was even a multi-step plan, mm-hmm. as I think you're about to describe as well. Like, this was kind of the start, and it was very much like almost like a Trojan horse or like a bait, right? Yeah. Where they knew by clearly violating both Apple's and Google's guidelines or rules for their app stores, for both the App Store and Google Play, they knew that Apple and Google would take action against them, right? Because that's so clearly against the rules, and it's been discussed so many times that it's not like Epic can say that, oh, we didn't know about that, right? Like, that's definitely not the case here. They deliberately did that on both Android and on iOS. And also one thing to clarify here is that, you know, when we talk about Android, Google Play is one of many app stores that can exist on the Android platform, with kind of an asterisk, because mm-hmm. Google does really want you to use Google Play as an Android manufacturer. But when it comes to payments, Google does allow apps to use different payment mechanisms, but not for games. So in the case of Fortnite, which is a very popular game that it ships on almost every platform that exists, it's almost like, you know, when you joke and you ask, like, does my refrigerator run Netflix, right? Because Netflix is on anything. It's almost the same with Fortnite at this point. It's like on almost every modern device that can run games. So Fortnite was required to use the Google Play in-app purchase payment mechanism, so it was also a violation of those rules as well.
Yeah, and we're going to focus on the Apple stuff because, of course, that's what we know about and what we can add to the conversation. We don't know much about how Android works or the Google Play works. I didn't even know the stuff you mentioned there.
Right. And of course, also, we know that this has been discussed and probably will be discussed on many other podcasts as well. So we don't want to go too much into the detail around like the kind of quote unquote politics around it, or, you know, what will happen with Epic and are they right? Is Apple right and wrong, etc.? Because that's not really the type of show that Stacktrace is. We want to focus on the technical aspect, but there's a lot of technical details here that I feel has a little bit been overlooked in this discussion, and like what that could also mean for this whole debate or this battle between these two companies or three companies. So we will focus on Apple and we will focus on the technical discussion. But first, I'm going to let Rambo continue his recap.
Yeah, so finishing up the story real quick, Apple removed Fortnite from the App Store. Google did the same as well. And then, like right after Epic released a lawsuit against both Apple and Google for the same reason. And Apple is now apparently threatening to revoke Epic's development accounts, all of their certificates, licenses, and everything. So basically, they're saying, hey, fix this, or we're going to basically kick you out of Apple software. That's basically what it means.
Yeah, because they already got kicked out of the App Store. Like that happened immediately, and that's when they launched the lawsuits and also kind of an in-game inside of Fortnite. They have these events, almost like press events inside of the game, which is kind of meta. They also had a video there, which was a parody of the classic Mac 1984 launch Super Bowl commercial, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, this was like a very, very orchestrated kind of attack, if you will, or at least like a campaign that they launched, Epic launched against both Google and Apple. And that has now caused Apple to not only remove Fortnite from the App Store, but also give Epic a deadline at which, if they are not in compliance, that they will revoke all of their certificates and end their development agreement. That's like the latest news as we have it today, as we record. But who knows what will happen tomorrow, right? Like this story has been developing really, really quickly.
Yeah, and this says a lot about what Tim Cook mentioned during that hearing about Apple doesn't retaliate, right?
Right, yeah. Although, to be fair, I mean, I'm not defending Tim Cook here at all. Not at all. But he did the fact that, you know, he said that Apple treats all developers the same, which we know is not true. But this is actually an instance of them doing that. Like, they are not giving Epic any special treatment. They are doing pretty much the same as they would do if one of us or some other developer did something like this. Although, probably we wouldn't get a deadline, right?
Exactly.
Like if an indie developer did something like this, they would just have their account terminated, no questions asked, probably. But yeah, it's interesting to see them go kind of so hard on this and to jump to this kind of pretty drastic measure so quickly.
Yeah, it's not like Apple is known for terminating people's developer accounts without even sending an email.
Right, exactly. In fact, that even happened to you, right?
Exactly. Anyway, that's not the topic here. Let's talk about the technical side, because I think that's where we can add to the discussion more than we could by talking about the politics. Where would you like me to start, John?
I think we should start at the beginning. So, like we mentioned before, inside of Fortnite, Epic remotely enabled the option to pay using their own system, circumventing the in-app purchase systems that Apple and Google have in place. Focusing again on iOS and Apple's platforms here, because that's what we know the most about technically, how do you think they could have done that? Like, what's your take on how did they actually accomplish that feat?
Well, a remote configuration of apps is something that's been going on for a real long time. And even if your app, like we talked about before, many apps are just pretty pictures of JSON. It's not a guy named JSON. It's JSON, the JavaScript Object Notation code, markup language, I guess. So yeah, so many apps are just rendering something they get from a server. So just by doing that, they are already very dynamic in nature, so they can change the content they're displaying very frequently. And not something that App Review could like have a preview of every single possible thing the app could display. That's not feasible. It's like solving the halting problem in computer science, right?
It's
not possible. But there is also another concept of feature switching, and there's also A-B testing. They're a little bit related, but I use this in Chibi Studio, by the way, and many, many, many apps use this, but I don't use it to enable a custom payment system. I wouldn't be crazy enough to do that. It's just like sometimes you want to release a feature, but you don't want to necessarily have to tie the release of that feature to a release of your app in the App Store. So let's say I'm releasing version 2.7 of my app, and I have a new feature that's implemented, but I also have a lot of other features and a lot of bug fixes. And this new feature in particular depends on some, I don't know, something from the legal department or from the commercial or marketing department of the company. They have to get something done before it's released, or there's some backend component which is not quite ready yet. But I really want to release the app and not have to release an update to enable that feature. That's where this type of feature switching comes into play. So I can release the update of my app with that feature disabled. And then in the future, when everything is ready, I can flip that switch on the backend. And the backend can be a lot of things. There are lots of services that implement this. I think Firebase has it. You can do it using CloudKit, which is what I do for Chibi Studio. So that's the gist of it. It's that you can release an update of the app and keep some things disabled remotely and then enable them.
Exactly.
This poses a problem for app review, though, because app review can't review a feature that's disabled. So one solution, many apps have accounts. And when your app has a login, you have to provide Apple with a sample account, so a login and a password they can use to test your app. So one of the options is to have a panel within the app that is enabled when using certain accounts that lets you enable all of the features locally. And most of the apps that use feature switches, they will have a hidden debug panel somewhere where you can locally enable those features just for yourself.
It's also super useful for QA, right? Mm-hmm. Or for debugging in general, just testing on device that you don't have to make a new build every time you want to test one of those new features, that you can just enable and disable them on the fly.
Yeah, and also so that you don't have to enable them for everyone just so that someone can test it. It's very common at the Jobby Job that we'll... at the Jobby Job, everything has a feature switch by default. That's the way we work. So when I send a build to QA, I always have to specify like, oh, you have to enable this particular feature switch to be able to test this. And sometimes it's actually multiple switches. So the way you can do that with App Review is give App Review access to all of the features, regardless of what's enabled on the backend. And of course, you're going to do that if you're not doing something nefarious with your feature switches, which you shouldn't, absolutely should not do that. So that's feature switches explained.
That's very good. And that is, of course, one way to make an app more dynamic while still utilizing 100% native code. Mm-hmm. So if you're writing your app in Objective-C or in Swift and so on and so forth, you can still make it dynamic just by including one of those feature switches. But there are also other ways to make an app dynamic. And one kind of obvious way is to use web views. So more apps than you might think embed web views as part of the app. So if you do your job right when you're implementing a web view, you can actually make it look very native, right? Yeah. Like, especially if you don't rely on any kind of heavy text input or something that is behaving differently in Safari and in WebKit versus UIKit and so on, then you can make a web view look pretty nice. And, you know, there's a lot of debates around, are web views good and so on? But I kind of think that if you do that work and if you embed them in a nice way and don't rely on them too much, then they can be a kind of nice way to share something that is content heavy between multiple platforms. And a lot of apps do that. Yeah. So web views is one of those things where you can point it to any URL, right? So you can also have a feature switch, or you can just reroute that URL to whatever content you want. And then the content of the app can change after the fact. And combine that with JavaScript, and combine that with all the APIs that let you communicate between JavaScript and native code, gives you a very dynamic setup.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and then the final way, at least that is relevant here, I think, is using different game engines. So Epic's game engine is called Unreal Engine. It's one of the top game engines on the market, and it's used by many, many companies and many apps, many games on many different platforms. And it's used by Fortnite, of course. And game engines have multiple ways of downloading new content and new logic even, and new like levels and things like that into the game at runtime. So it doesn't have to be compiled into the app, but rather downloaded ad hoc. And this is another thing where you could download a different bundle almost, just like your thing you talked about earlier, Rambo, and just have that launched by the game engine. So this could also have been one way that they could have done this as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's an interesting one, like how they managed to get this past app review. And there are many different options, like we just mentioned. And all of these techniques that we just talked about are not nefarious, right? Like they can be used for these kind of purposes. They can be used to hide things from app review, but they can also be used in so many legitimate ways, some of which we talked about already. But the next thing I want to talk about from like a technical point of view. So we mentioned that right now Apple has threatened to revoke all of Epic's development privileges, right?
Yeah.
There's been a lot of debate around this, around like what would that mean for end users. So let's talk about that. What actually happens technically for a developer when they get their account terminated?
Sure. So there are multiple levels at which Apple can act here. And some of them will mean that the developer can't update their apps anymore or can't release new versions on the Mac or something. And another end of the spectrum is your apps won't launch anymore for users. That's like the other end of the spectrum. So if their account is simply terminated, they won't be able to update their apps anymore, and they won't be able to notarize their builds for macOS or anything like that. But then there's another thing that Apple could do, which is actually revoke their certificates and revoke the permission for their apps to run on iOS and on the Mac. So that's something Apple can also do. And in that case, if you try to launch the app on iOS, it won't launch anymore. And if you try to, even if you've already got it installed since a long time ago, and also if you try to run one of their apps on your Mac, it's going to throw up a dialogue saying, oh, Apple can't check this for malware, move it to the trash, whatever, something like that.
Yeah.
So basically rendering all of their apps unusable.
Exactly. And there's been a lot of speculation over the last couple of days what this could mean for both users of Fortnite and players, but also for users, developers that are using Unreal Engine, right? Because like we mentioned, the Unreal Engine is super popular and is used by so many AAA games and smaller indie developers. Like there's a huge range of developers using Unreal Engine to build games, both for iOS and for many other platforms.
Including games on Apple Arcade.
Exactly, yeah. So if the certificates are revoked, like if everything gets shut down, of course users won't be able to launch Fortnite anymore, right? Or any other games that Epic have shipped on either iOS or the Mac or tvOS.
Yeah.
So that would just mean like a kill switch basically, right? So you would try to launch Fortnite, it would just wouldn't work. However, the thing that I think has been, at least in the coverage I've been following, that has been a little bit missed. So people have been talking about Unreal Engine and they've said that, well, even if Apple does this, that doesn't mean that all games using Unreal Engine will also just stop launching. And that's true. Like, if you are using Unreal Engine to build a game, it won't just stop working immediately if this happens, right?
Yeah.
So you are not signing your game with Epic certificates. You are, like we talked about actually, with your bundles, Rambo, right?
Yeah.
Like when you're embedding a framework, you are still signing the end product, the end code with your development account. So that wouldn't be affected by this. However, to actually use Unreal Engine, you have to use the Unreal Engine IDE. And to use that, you have to go through the Epic Games launcher, at least on the Mac, if you're using Unreal Engine on the Mac. And if that would happen, if they would revoke the certificates, then they could not notarize those builds anymore, which means that the Epic Game launcher wouldn't launch by default. And you could work around that with, you know, like disabling system integrity protection and all those things, but this would actually be a pretty big like negative for even developers using Unreal Engine.
Yeah, I would say any like big studio that's using Unreal Engine would probably have minor issues with this, because all Epic would do would be, oh, just disable SIP and right-click, open, and accept the dialogue, and that's it. Like, it isn't like it's impossible to run Unreal Engine on the Mac anymore. But especially for like people who are just getting started or some smaller game devs and they don't know about how system integrity protection works or anything like that, it is a big issue because it's quite a scary dialogue that shows up. And the scariness of the dialogue kind of makes it clear that this was mainly designed for malware prevention.
Yeah.
But Apple apparently is starting to want to use this for other reasons. So reasons other than malware. And I think this is a very heavy hammer that shouldn't be used willy-nilly. Like, there's been a recent story, I'm not going to go into detail here, but there was an indie developer recently. Apple accidentally revoked their privileges and they got like thousands of support emails because people were getting this warning that their app was malware when trying to run it. Like, this is really, really bad.
It really is. And we have to remember that even if you're a game developer and you're using Unreal Engine, you might not know what notarization is, right? Yeah. You might not know why this is happening. And all of a sudden you think your computer is infected by malware. Like, that is going to be pretty bad, right? So yeah, like you say, this is a very heavy hammer. And of course, you could argue all sorts of arguments on both sides of this issue. Like, you know, that Epic has violated the terms of the development agreement, and therefore it is within Apple's rights to close that down and so on and so forth. And you can also argue Epic's side of the things and, you know, all the things in their lawsuit and so on and so forth. But regardless of which kind of side you're on in this debate, I think there's no denying that this is a very, very heavy hammer, like you're saying. This is a very drastic thing to do, especially given this developer in particular, where they are vending this IDE, this tool, this game engine that so many other developers are using.
Yeah, not getting too much into the politics of it here. I think many people miss the point, like, oh, of course Apple can do this. It's their platform, it's their app store, they have the terms and so on and so forth. But we're not arguing whether Apple can do this. We're arguing whether they should do it. That's a very different story.
Exactly. It really is. And of course, another thing that also would be very impacted is Epic's ability to keep updating Unreal Engine, because if they don't have access to the development tools, of course, all of their developers can still download Xcode, because that's just an app you can download from the App Store. But actually, you know, using that as a real development environment is going to be problematic without a developer account.
Yeah, but technically, when that happens, you are not allowed to use Xcode.
Right, like, exactly.
Of course you can. Like, it's not like there's going to be an Apple lawyer looking over your shoulder and you launch Xcode and they're like, oh, we're suing you for using Xcode. But yeah, it's not technically you aren't even allowed to use Xcode if that happens. And of course you are even less allowed to use beta releases of Xcode, which you have to be logged in with a paid developer account in order to get.
Exactly. And I'm just very curious, or I don't know if that's too positive of a word, or scared or concerned, how this will affect the relationship between Unreal Engine and Apple's platforms going forward. Because Unreal Engine really is, at least in my opinion, like the state of the art for 3D graphics. And so many AAA and really powerful, capable games are using Unreal Engine. And gaming on Apple's platforms has already been in a kind of rocky state, to say the least, right? And I just fear that this could really kind of hurt that relationship and make the Mac and iOS kind of less of a priority for Unreal Engine, which I think would be a shame. I mean, now I'm kind of speculating here, but I'm just saying that this can have some pretty big ramifications, and it's going really fast. And I'm just kind of like, yeah, I don't know where this will end up.
Yeah, I think the conclusion is that this isn't going to end well for anyone, basically. Regardless of what you think about Epic Games, like, I'm not a fan. I barely know them. I'm not a gamer, as you've probably noticed. Regardless of what you think of Apple, this is Apple is basically looking like the bad guy here. Regardless of whether you think they're right, they're wrong, Epic is this, Epic is that, Apple is doing something that they, I don't know, I don't think they should be doing this. I think they're going too far, and it's looking really bad for them, and there is a huge amount of people who are into gaming who are seeing Apple as the bad guy, and they don't like us, and they're against Epic, and yeah, I don't think this is going to end well.
Yeah, exactly, and add on top of that the fact that this is not the first time that the App Store has come up as a controversy during the last couple of weeks, because like we mentioned, it feels like every week there's another big scandal. And we talked about some of the kind of antitrust hearings that are going on, both in the US and also in EU is starting and so on and so forth. So yeah, it feels like there's a lot of forces at play here. And I hope that Apple is considering all of this stuff, and I hope that they will change something, because clearly, regardless of what you think about what is in Apple's right versus not, clearly, like, this is not working from like a business perspective in the whole industry, right? Because yeah, there are so many big companies being very upset, and users are kind of getting caught up in the middle of this where they are getting apps that are not as capable as they could have been. So yeah, I think regardless of what side you're on and what you think about all this, I just hope that this will get kind of resolved one way or another in a way that everybody's happy with. Probably everybody won't be happy with it, but I hope that something will happen and that Apple won't just keep going the way they've been going, because it's clearly not working.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll see. If you want to hear a more comprehensive discussion of the possible implications and the future of the App Store and also the regulations that could happen, I think this week's upgrade is a great listening for that. What do you think, John?
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed the latest episode of Upgrade. Like I always do, I love Upgrade. I think it's a great podcast with Jason and Mike. So we'll put a link in the show notes to the latest episode where they talked about this particular thing. But now let's move over to our final segment, because just like on the last episode, we kind of did a hybrid here between in the news and our technical deep dive. So we're going to move over now to Ask Tech Trace to kind of finish off this episode. And we talked a little bit about forms before and forms using Swift UI and how nice that is. But we have a question here from Mrabti. I'm sorry if I didn't pronounce that correctly. And Mrabti says that I have in my app some forms written using UIKit and I'm rewriting them now using Swift UI. And Mrabti says that the declarative way of programming has proven to be quite challenging, especially when it comes to handling things like text fields and focus, and asks if there's any way to extend Swift UI to handle such cases. So we talked about the declarative aspects of Swift UI being nice for forms in that you don't have to do so much state management when it comes to displaying different controls and doing validation and those sorts of things. But when it comes to determining what controls that have focus and doing more kind of granular state management and state code, that can be a little bit more challenging with Swift UI. So have you encountered anything like this, Rambo? And do you have any tips?
I didn't have to deal with text field focus specifically, but what I've noticed working with Swift UI is the thing we talked about a lot already, which is you have to change the way you're thinking. And the way you think in this case might be like, oh, I want to make this text field become focused. And that's an imperative thing. You don't do that in Swift UI. You have to think of everything in terms of state. So you're probably going to have a state that describes what's in focus. And that's what's going to be driving this in your UI. So I think maybe in this case, they are hitting some limitation of Swift UI. Maybe you can't control focus at all with Swift UI. I don't know, because I haven't had to deal with it myself. But regardless, that's how you should be thinking about it. Because if you're thinking about it like, oh, I'm going to make this thing do this, then you're thinking it wrong, like Steve Jobs would say.
Exactly. So to add to that, there aren't at the time of recording, at least as far as I'm aware, any native APIs in Swift UI that lets you tell that a given view should have focus. So there's no like is focused modifier or something like that. So for this, you do have to dive deeper into either UIKit or AppKit. So I've had to do this in a few apps that I worked on where I've had to add programmatic focus to some UI controls. And the way I've done that is that I've written a thin wrapper around, for example, UI text field, where I have a property. So I do want to expose the API as a declarative API. So I have a state property or a binding where you can modify the focus state. So you can say is focused true or false. And then that will in turn either assign the first responder or make that UI text field the first responder. So you do have to use the responders chain still, and there's no built-in way, at least again, as far as I'm aware, to do that natively in Swift UI. But the good news is that it's not that complex to do it. Like, you can use either UI view representable or NS view representable and wrap those UIKit or AppKit controls and expose an API that way. So I'm sure this is something that's going to be addressed in future releases of Swift UI, but this is currently something that we still have to do manually for now.
Yeah, and we see a lot of this with working with SwiftUI. There's the difference between imperative and declarative aspect, which is tricky, but there's also the issue of some things simply aren't implemented yet, so you have to find workarounds. And I think that's the situation that's happening here. And I've seen many people say, like, oh, you can't use SwiftUI because you can't, I don't know, control focus of text fields. And I don't think that's the case. Like, if that's really, really important in your use case, yeah, maybe for that particular part of your app, you're not going to be able to use SwiftUI, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't use it for anything.
Exactly. And one thing, I know that Mrapti said this just as part of the question here, so I don't want to pick on it too much, but I hear this term rewriting in SwiftUI a lot. And I feel like when people have the expectation of rewriting something like an app or a view or anything else like in SwiftUI, they almost have this expectation that they will go from having used 100% UIKit to 100% SwiftUI. And I think that's an expectation that we probably shouldn't have at this point. And I really don't think that SwiftUI needs to be something that covers 100% of all use cases to be usable. It's fine, completely fine for me to mix and match. In fact, that's how SwiftUI was designed to begin with, to be mixable and matchable with both UIKit and AppKit. And I think that's a great strength of it. So when I go into writing something with SwiftUI, I don't necessarily think that I will do this 100% always with SwiftUI. It might be I do it with 50% SwiftUI or 60%, 70%, doesn't really matter. But the cool thing is that even if I do jump down to UIKit or AppKit for certain tasks like managing focus or something else, I still get all of the nice things about SwiftUI, the layout system, the state management system, and all of the built-in controls, all for quote-unquote free, right? So even if I do have to do some work to bridge those things from UIKit or AppKit to SwiftUI, I still feel, at least from my perspective, it's worth it to at least use SwiftUI where I can if I can not support older operating system versions for that particular project. So I do still think that there's a trade-off between all of these different frameworks, but I don't think that we should see having to sometimes fill the gaps in the API as such a big negative thing, which again, I don't think Mrapti said here with the question, but this is just a kind of a side note.
Yeah.
Cool. And our second and final question for this episode comes from another name I will have a hard time pronouncing. I'm very sorry, but I will try. Pravtamesh, who asks if we use OS log in our apps and is using the console app to check logs worth the amount of logs generated in it. So Rambo, I think this is a question for you because you are a big fan of OS log. So tell us all about it.
OS log, all the things.
Exactly. Write your whole app in OS log.
OS log driven development. That would be great. Yeah, I use OS log a lot, and mainly because it's very cheap. It doesn't affect your performance significantly like other logging solutions. And it really helps, especially when I'm working in something like AirBuddy, which is a lot of subsystems and different processes and things like that. It will really be hard to be hitting breakpoints all the time to be able to debug stuff. A lot of it is timing related. So I do use OS log extensively and for other things as well. So in terms of the amount of logs, that's the beauty of OS log, because of course, if you launch, everyone who's listening, launch the console app on your Mac right now. You're going to see like a huge fire hose of logs. And really, if you look at it, you're going to be like, nope, and just quit it.
Yeah.
But the beauty of OS log is that you can specify, first of all of the different levels of logging. So it can be info, debug, error, fault, all of those things. But also, when you create an OS log object, you give it a subsystem and a category. And in the console app, you can filter by subsystem, category, and lots of other things as well. So whenever I'm using the console app, I'm never looking at the fire hose of logs. I am always filtering by some subsystem or some category. So and also the good thing, especially if you're working on a Mac app, is you don't even have to use the console app, which I don't like to do sometimes because it is quite heavy. Like it can take a lot of processing and memory. So in the roots folder of AirBuddy, actually I'm looking at it now and I should probably move them to a separate folder because there's lots of them. But I have lots of shell scripts which are to log things related to specific parts of the app. And when I invoke those shell scripts, they invoke the log command. So you can call log stream, and then there are lots of parameters, which I'm not going to describe here because I'm not going to be reading code on a podcast. But you can basically filter, you can stream logs, filtering by a subsystem, which is what I do here. So I have one, for instance, which is asset logs, and it will filter by the subsystem codes.rambo.aircar.assetmanagement, which is the thing that handles assets. I also have Bluetooth logs, listening mode logs, mobile device logs, RSSI logs, and many other logs. I log all the things. So what those shell scripts allow me to do is when I'm working on something in AirBuddy, let's say I'm doing something related to listening mode where I change the transparency and noise cancellation, things like that, I'm going to invoke the listening mode logs shell script, and it's going to stream everything that has to do with listening modes within AirBuddy. And not only the AirBuddy helper process itself, but any other XPC services it uses. So that's the beauty of OSLog, is that you can filter so you don't have to be looking at the huge and scrolling fire hose of logs in the console app. So yeah, I highly recommend it.
Another thing I want to add, which is a benefit of OSLog over something like print, is that OSLog has a much, much smaller performance overhead.
Mm-hmm.
So you can leave it in your app even when shipping it to production, and even when just iterating, you can leave those OSLog statements within your source code. And I know that some people, they find it, they're almost allergic to it. Like when they see some logging code in quote unquote normal code or in your like UI code or something, they really don't like that. But if you're working on an app like AirBuddy or something else where you are having a lot of state and you have a lot of signal processing and things like that, it can be incredibly useful for debugging. Like when you encounter a bug, you can go and look at those logs on your local machine and you can see what actually happened, right? Or the order of events. Because that's something that breakpoints is not that great at, where if you are debugging mostly by setting breakpoints, you are causing additional like latency and things because your program is stopping, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing like a lot of real-time signal processing, that's going to be really difficult to debug using breakpoints. Although I love breakpoints and I use them for many other kinds of tasks. It's all like you need to use a combination, I think, of different techniques. But that's the benefit of OSLog, because one thing that I think sometimes gets overlooked with print is that it's quite expensive. Like calling print is quite expensive. In fact, I had a situation a few years ago when I was building like a really performance sensitive algorithm. And when I was doing that, I was using print. Like I put prints everywhere to like debug this thing because it was the same thing. It was very like a lot of real time signal processing going into this algorithm. So it was kind of difficult to do it with breakpoints. And then when I was done and I had solved all the bugs, I still found it like it was really slow. And I was like, why is this so slow? It should be efficient. And then I realized that if I just remove all the print statements, it was lightning fast. So that is something to be careful about as well. So I still use print for kind of quick things where I just want to log something quickly. I use OS log for things I want to leave in my code base that are more permanent logs. And also, like Rambo mentioned, when you want to separate them out into different subsystems. And then I use breakpoints when I want to debug my app, and I actually do want to stop it in that particular state. I don't want it to continue. So that's kind of my general debugging strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, another thing is that you can benefit from OS log even when you're not in a context where you're debugging your app. So a big aspect of AirBuddy development is that I dogfood it a lot because I'm like the primary user of the app. So in developing AirBuddy 2, which I've been doing for a long time, as our listeners know, I am using it daily, and I'm not always with it in Xcode running. I'm mostly running it as a normal app like my users will do. And what I do is I always have a terminal window open or a tab with the AirBuddy logs streaming using the log command I talked about. And it's filtering by the subsystems of the AirCar framework and the AirUI framework, which are my car and UI frameworks, so that I get basically everything. So whenever something doesn't do what I expected it to do, like, oh, I tried to change the listening mode on my AirPods using the keyboard shortcut, that's revealing a new feature right there. And it doesn't do it, I can go to that terminal window and I can scroll up a little bit, and now I'm going to see some sort of error, or I'm going to see some weird sequence of events that shouldn't happen. And then I have an idea of what happened. And if I was just printing everything, I wouldn't get the same visibility. Not to mention as well the advantage that OS log, when you interpolate strings within your logs, they are private by default. So in a release build of the app, it's going to show like just private instead of showing the actual string, which is useful when you're logging potentially sensitive data.
Yeah, especially if you're building an SDK or something, right? Where those print statements, if they were, would just show up in the user's actual Xcode, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I totally agree with that as well. I think it's a very big advantage of OS log. But you know, like I mentioned before, I think still print has its use cases. So it's not that I'm saying never use print, only use OS log. And I don't think that's what you're saying either, Rambo.
Yeah.
But I still think it's very useful for certain kinds of logs and things that you want to be more permanent. Or if you're like Rambo and you just want to feed everything in there and get that fire hose of logs, mm-hmm. and then you can filter it. So it all depends on what your preferred debugging strategy is.
Yeah, I would say if you are on iOS and one of the things you have to do with the logs is collect them from users' devices, then OS log is not a good idea. I mean, you should still use it for your own debugging, but you should probably look at some third-party option in that case, because on iOS, you can't, at least not at the time of recording, from within your own app capture the logs you've emitted, which is different. On the Mac, you can actually do that. So yeah, on iOS, I would be looking for a different solution if you need to collect logs from users' devices.
Exactly. And I think that's a great way to end this episode of Stacktrace. So just to remind everybody, you can always ask us a question, and please do that. We love to get your questions. So if you have anything during this episode that you would like us to dive more into detail on, or if you have a completely new question, just tweet with a hashtag AskStackTrace, and we'll pick that question up and hopefully answer it on a future episode. But all that remains for this episode is to thank our great sponsor, iAmazing, for sponsoring this entire month of Stacktrace. That's been a really big help for us in making this podcast possible. So please do check them out at iamazing.com/stacktrace. And of course, a big thank you to all of you for listening as well. And that's it. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.